Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
Orange County announces two major changes to how it handles immigration enforcement. It will limit the number of ICE detainees at the jail and stop a controversial cycle of removing and rebooking used to extend a detainee's time in custody. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It's Thursday, February 5th, 2026. This week, Mayor Jerry Deming sent a letter to Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement outlining operational changes he says are needed to address strained staffing and resources, and to operate a safe and efficient jail for Orange County residents. He also wrote the county remains committed to supporting federal immigration enforcement, and the updated guidelines align the Corrections Department housing practices with the existing intergovernmental service agreement the county has with ICE. According to the Orange County Corrections Department, the number of people in custody solely because of ICE detainers with no local charges jumped from single digits to more than 140 a day on average. That's about a 1,500% increase in 1 year. Beginning March 1st, Orange County Corrections will cap the number of ICE detainees with no local charges at 66 men and 64 women. Also beginning in March, Orange County will eliminate the practice of multiple bookings for the same immigration matter. This is how attorney Josephine Arroyo explains a process she says ICE is using to bypass the 72-hour holding limit, essentially keeping her clients locked up longer than the law allows.
This is not an isolated incident. It is a pattern. Orange County is allowing ICE to circumvent the law by removing individuals every 72 hours, then bringing them back, rebooking them under a new booking number, artificially resetting the clock, prolonging detention without due process.
Josephine and her husband, Philip, own the Arroyo Law Firm in Orlando, and they're filing legal requests in court called habeas corpus petitions to claim their clients are being held in detention illegally. She says they're representing 20 of those cases. So far, they've won 5, including 2 on Tuesday, where a federal judge decided their immigrant client was being held illegally. In one of those cases, the federal prosecutor backed away from his own argument against her firm's client in court.
He indicated they were withdrawing their response because it was inaccurate, that he took an oath, and he had an ethical duty and obligation, and that he was joining in our petition for the habeas corpus.
What is your reaction hearing that a federal prosecutor says on the record that the government's own arguments were not consistent with his oath to the Constitution?
It was extremely refreshing. That is even what the judge said, because I think that Phil and I kind of thought we were in a twilight zone for some time, and reading the responses, we couldn't believe the arguments that they were making, specifically under section of the statute that said that they were required to be under mandatory detention. But that specific provision of the statute was essentially for people just crossing the border and entering inspection. All of these clients that we've been representing have been in the U.S. for many years.
Are the habeas petitions being filed because of the rebooking that you're seeing happening at the jail, or are there other reasons that you're asking a judge to review immigrant clients are being detained illegally?
First, we started solely because they were being held unlawfully. You know, they were arrested with no warrant. They didn't even have, you know, a notice to appear. They didn't have removal proceedings. But the rebooking is what triggered it, because if somebody is continuously rebooked back to the jail, then immigration court has no jurisdiction. So some of these clients that we did habeas on were originally clients for bond. So we were going to try to get bond in immigration court, but they were never getting to immigration. So they were just kept doing this cycle in the jail. And that's when the family and us, you know, they started to get very stressed and frustrated. Like, why can't you file the motion for bond? And we're like, they're not in the jurisdiction of immigration, so we can't file anything. So that's what triggered us starting to do the habeases was the rebooking.
Are you able to find all of your clients in custody?
It is always a chore. It takes a lot of time. I have to speak to supervisors because sometimes the inmate records, they are like, I don't see them here. I have to say, I know she was there yesterday. I was just there. Did she get picked up today? And then they tell me, you know, oh, finally, after like, you know, 5-10 minutes of digging, they let me know that she was just taken, you know, to ICE. Sometimes when they're rebooked, it takes them a while to update the system, which is why there's been many times where we're at the jail trying to find our client or calling to find our client, and they tell us that they're not there, but indeed they are, and it wasn't in the system.
And one of your clients, Javier Jimenez Rivero, Venezuelan immigrant who's been living in the U.S. for years, was detained by ICE even though he wasn't charged with a crime and had no valid deportation order. Federal judge ordered his release, and that order says, quote, in this country, we don't enforce the law by breaking the law, end quote. What does that statement mean related to these detentions?
That is one of my favorite quotes from the order. That order came in very late one night, and reading that with so much joy because, again, it solidified that what we knew was right in our gut ended up being then memorialized in an order. I believe it really encompasses what sadly we are witnessing in this country right now, that you see it on the news and maybe you don't fully believe it. But then it happens to somebody close to you, or you're representing a client who was actually snatched off the street and just taken into a jail without a warrant, without probable cause, without a deportation order, without even removal proceedings starting. Somebody who's here lawfully with a pending asylum, with a worker's permit that was actually issued by the very agency that then ends up taking into custody. So I think it's a very remarkable statement that is indicative of what we're seeing right now, that you can't enforce the law by doing things unlawfully.
That was attorney Josephine Arroyo, co-owner of the Arroyo Law Firm, a criminal defense and immigration firm in Orlando, describing what she says is a pattern of prolonged detentions. To better understand the legal framework, we're joined by Stetson University College of Law professor Michael Vasteen. He explains what is allowed by law and what judges can do if authorities overstep.
Habeas corpus is the right for anyone to challenge the constitutionality of their detention. In immigration, this is very important because vast numbers of people are subject to something called mandatory detention under the immigration statute. And so historically, they would bring habeas challenges if their detention became prolonged, meaning their immigration case had dragged on for a long time, typically after 6 months or a year. Many immigrants could be successful challenging that they had a liberty interest and the detention had become too long, or after they were ordered removed, and if the government was not able to remove them to their home country, eventually, again, after 6 months, they would have a liberty interest in being released. The Supreme Court had to deal with those two questions in the early 2000s, and they upheld the constitutionality of mandatory detention.
So why are we seeing habeas corpus being used so frequently right now?
In the news, you see a variety of circumstances in which immigrants are being arrested without warrants. So warrantless arrest could be a basis for bringing a claim. Sometimes they're being held in places where they lacked access to counsel. That was an issue, particularly in South Florida with the detention center in the Everglades. The detainees that were held at that facility did not have access to an immigration court. There were questions about which even federal courts had oversight of that facility. And so individual detainees were bringing claims based on habeas corpus because they were denied their due process rights and their access to counsel. And a huge number of cases have been brought now because the Trump administration I guess the immigration courts under the Department of Justice adopted a litigation position first raised by Immigration and Customs Enforcement that huge numbers of immigrants without status should be subject to mandatory detention. That is, that they should always be considered that they were, quote, arriving aliens, end quote, because would-be immigrants at the border without papers are also subject to mandatory detention. But there was decades of precedent that long-term undocumented people in the U.S. are eligible for bond. So there's been litigation using habeas corpus challenging the legality of that change of the government's position.
One case in Central Florida, Javier Jimenez Rivero's case, the judge ruled that immigration enforcement detained him without charges, a warrant, or a hearing. Can you explain what that ruling means legally and why it matters for him and others?
Without getting into the specifics of the case, which would be unfair for me to do, well, if someone is arrested without a warrant, and we've got questions of what's, you know, come out in the news around Minnesota, if the government is asserting that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to non-citizens, that's a pretty big stretch. What is their remedy to being subject to what seems like an arbitrary warrantless arrest, or even the result of unlawful profiling? It's going to be a writ of habeas corpus to have not a judge from the immigration courts within the Department of Justice, but a federal judge at a U.S. district court to rule on the constitutionality of the decision by a law enforcement officer to bring them into detention in the first place.
From your experience, what is the impact on people and their families of the people who are detained in the way we're talking about?
The experience is really, really disastrous because, first of all, there's no right to counsel in the, or there's no right to court-appointed counsel in the immigration realm. And so many foreign nationals are navigating this, if they don't have the resources, without counsel. So that's disorienting and hard to assert their rights. And meanwhile, if they're financially precarious, and eventually if someone is in a prison or a detention center, they become financially precarious, well, what happens to their family? What happens to their stability of their housing if they lose their job? So asserting a constitutional right and getting out, you'll see in the news that celebrations of people achieving their release. But what happened during the period of time that they were unlawfully detained is their life fell apart, and now they have to rebuild from a deficit.
These cases where a judge is saying that ICE detained someone unlawfully, we're seeing it happen all over the country. Are these rulings unusual to you, or is this part of a trend in federal courts you're seeing?
It's a trend because the immigrants tend to be winning a lot. It's also a trend in that historically, challenges to detention that it had been prolonged or become unconstitutionally indefinite, they were pretty rare. So what we have now is, I wouldn't call it a proportionate response to the current enforcement, but arising from this really broad assertion of federal authority is the population of non-citizens asserting their constitutional rights. So we've got this tension of the administration is testing limits and testing norms, and the courts are checking it.
What about the people who say ICE is just doing its job, and sometimes you're going to have to get a few people into custody who shouldn't have been arrested, but that doesn't take away from the work that they're doing?
I don't really think that that's defensible. ICE is supposed to operate with warrants. Having a warrant for an arrest is just a basis of a free society. And so coloring outside the lines is not really an option. As hopefully has become clear, bringing a habeas petition is a chore. It's a burden for anyone, attorney or not, to file something, to have to affirmatively assert their rights. So it seems problematic that the question, the underlying issue, has turned power on its head. If the non-citizen is obligated to assert their rights on an affirmative basis in order to have them, then I think that we're in trouble.
Michael, do these rulings actually change what ICE can do?
Yes, over time they will. As relates to the individuals, a successful habeas petition will get that individual their freedom if the judge has ordered it, or it will get them a bond hearing if the judge has ordered it. It sets up some guardrails that give some confidence in the idea that they are entitled to due process of law. And I think just over time, with enough numerosity, it should make a systemic change. The executive branch has prerogative about its executive enforcement, and certainly now has the budget to do incredibly broad things. And so now it's the role of the courts to, again, put the guardrails on how that vast authority can be executed.
In recent days, a federal judge has now freed several Venezuelan immigrants in Central Florida, and it's warning ICE and local jail officials they could be held in contempt for violating court orders. For those of us who aren't lawyers, what does it actually mean when a federal judge says he's considering holding the government in contempt?
The court can issue fines. In some circumstances, they can issue punitive sanctions, being detention. The issue, though, is the courts require enforcement of their orders. So there's a natural tension between when the state and federal executives are doing things that are in contempt, well, who's going to carry out the will of the courts? And that's really like the razor's edge of lawlessness, I suppose.
What should we be paying attention to in terms of what happens next?
The issue really is you're looking at a vulnerable population without political clout, who are having enforcement targeted at them based on First Amendment violations, such as freedom of speech, you know, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth Amendment violations about access to counsel, you know, due process protections, and then questions about whether, you know, even the Eighth Amendment about being free from cruel and unusual punishment when our government subsidizes or directly pays for foreign detention under torturous conditions, as well as our international violations under various instruments. So if this erosion of fundamental rights and norms is happening to weak people, it can't be ignored, because who is next? Once the constitutional rights don't apply to somebody unpopular, what if you become unpopular?
Michael Vasteen is a visiting professor of law at Stetson University. An issue that keeps coming up is how long someone can be held in local custody on an ICE detainer without any immigration proceedings moving forward. Attorneys say the time limits are meant to keep people from sitting in jail indefinitely without due process. Orlando attorney Walker Smith says some of his clients are choosing to leave the state because of what's happening.
It starts with preparation. Have a family plan in case something happens to you. Who's going to take care of your kids? Who's going to come get your car so it doesn't get towed away? Whose number do you have memorized? Make sure to memorize phone numbers now, especially of your emergency contact. The recourse after that, once someone has been detained, if they have a criminal charge, it's to speak with the public defender. Ask them if they can either get them in contact with the criminal attorney, but they don't want to say too much over the phone to their family members either, because all those phone calls are recorded. So you don't want to mention like an undocumented family member's name, for example, that they could then pass on to ICE. You don't want to reveal too much information in those recorded phone calls, whereas the conversations with the attorney are protected. So if they can talk to that public defender, that's the first recourse, is talk to the public defender, try and get yourself an immigration attorney. And if you can't, at least ask the public defender what your recourses are. For the people with no criminal charges, it's difficult. Unfortunately, at this time, the number one recourse is just the habeas petition. And that is once they've been held longer than 72 hours on just the immigration hold. So I think people have to be willing to file suit is the number one thing. The other recourse, and it's unfortunate, but it's the recourse that I've seen most common, is people are self-deporting. They are being given the option of staying in jail, getting transferred to Alligator Alcatraz, or one of my clients got transferred up to Texas. Another one was transferred over to Georgia. And people don't want to stay in jail indefinitely. So they're taking the recourse of being deported either to their home country, in some instances, other countries.
Have you had a client do that?
I've had multiple clients do that. I had four clients go to Guatemala. They voluntarily deported the entire family, including an 18-year-old and a 21-year-old. And then I had a client recently who just told me, look, I don't want to be here. I'll go back to Mexico. And he went back to Mexico. And the problem is the people, once they've been detained, aren't getting any of the offers, like the $2,600 that they offered them. They don't get that because it's not considered to be a voluntary self-departure. And it's sad. They really shouldn't be having to decide between staying in jail and being deported to a country where, and a lot of times they haven't been there their whole lives. Their position is, well, they should have done it before they got detained. And my position is, well, you're going after people who've never been criminals. You're targeting people because they're driving while Latino, essentially, or they, you know, don't have a valid license. And at that point, you're creating a criminal record to justify locking them up. So it would have been voluntary if they were given the opportunity, but they're sort of creating this criminal record and taking that choice away from them.
That was Orlando attorney Walker Smith. There's more ahead here on Engage. A decision this week impacts thousands of Central Floridians. The end of TPS for Haitians is now on hold. Subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you never miss an episode. This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Ahead on the program, few musical instruments are as ubiquitous to the American soundscape as the clarinet.
It's a sound you don't hear often nowadays. And sometimes it takes that single note, like in Rhapsody in Blue when the clarinet does that gliss. I can't think of another instrument that can sound just like that.
Members of the 40-player plus Licorice Sticks clarinet band join Engage in studio. But first, members of Central Florida's Haitian community are feeling rejoice and relief today, tempered by the worry that comes with uncertainty. A day before temporary protected status for Haiti was scheduled to end this week on February 3rd, a United States district court blocked the Trump administration from terminating the protections. The U.S. first gave TPS to Haitians after a devastating earthquake hit the island in 2010. The designation allows recipients to live and work in America while shielding them from deportation. Central Florida has the second largest Haitian community in Florida. It's home to about 40,000 people who have immigrated here or are the children of immigrants, according to the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute. Ann Pierville is a Haitian-American lawyer in Orlando, working to calm fears and educate the Haitian immigrant community about what this decision means.
There has been a lot of hope in the community, but the reality of it is that we were very stressed and very worried about what could have happened if over 300,000 individuals lost their legal status and their ability to work, drive, and support their family and children. And that's very scary. You know, I am a child of an immigrant. My parents came to the U.S. seeking a better life for me. They were farm workers when they first came to the U.S. And I see how they struggled and how they were able to, you know, build this family so I can do the work that I do now. But I know it was never easy. It was always a sacrifice of their love and their time to ensure that I could do the things that they thought necessary for me. So I can only imagine the families that were just hoping, praying, wanting TPS to be extended, knowing that, you know, everything is just kind of waiting on what this administration does or what this lawsuit would announce to us. And so it was very, very hard for the community. We've been doing a lot of outreach to the churches, the local organizations, this just to ensure that the community had the information needed if we didn't get the result that we got from this lawsuit.
You mentioned that you've been on the ground leading these Know Your Rights sessions, working with churches and business groups. What kind of questions have you heard over the last year?
A lot of the questions we got were about their immigration status. And so what's next? And so, you know, we are pushing and hoping that Congress will create a law that provides pathway to a legal permanent residency for TPS and DACA holders so they can eventually become U.S. citizens. But right now, that's just not there. And so people want to know, well, what are my other options? You know, I want to remain legal in the United States with a legal status. I want to be able to work. And so those are the main questions. These are taxpayers. They want to be sure that they can pay their mortgages and their rent and they can buy food for their family. So those are a lot of the questions we get. What do I do with my things that I've accumulated? My assets, my home, my bank accounts. A lot of people want to know, do we still go to work? Are our children safe to go to school? Will we get a call that our children are being picked up? So a lot of families had questions on what's next, what does this look like for us? And they want to know, what do we do if ICE does come to our door, if ICE comes to the local school or to the church? And so we provided all that type of information to the community so they can create those safety plans. And so they'd be educated in making their next steps so they knew what their options were.
Do you feel like the concerns that you were hearing about ICE is related to uncertainty with TPS status?
Absolutely. TPS, temporary protected status, provides protections from being held in ICE detention and deportation. So when we hear termination of TPS and that individual doesn't have another legal status, that person now can be detained and deported. And we understand the huge humanitarian situation in Haiti. Haiti simply cannot at this moment accept the number of people that would have to return to Haiti if they were picked up, detained, and then deported to Haiti. And so a lot of people are scared because if TPS is terminated, what do I do? I no longer have this protection. I may have a pending application, but I don't have a legal status right now. And I have a family. I don't want to be separated from my family. And so a lot of people were concerned and are still very concerned about their interactions with ICE if there are changes to TPS.
Now that the court has blocked the Trump administration from ending temporary protected status this week, you mentioned feeling a sense of relief. I'm curious if you also have concerns that it could be short-lived.
This is just one step. Like I said, we are still moving forward. This is a good first step. You know, individuals did not lose TPS on February 3rd, as it was announced by this administration, but TPS is still just a temporary status.
How do you respond to the people who argue that TPS was always meant to be temporary?
And we understand that. And we understand that, unfortunately, the country is still having great, great difficulties from political to economic to security and to natural disasters. And so we understand that there is a large humanitarian issue in Haiti. And so we understand that this is a temporary status. However, it is not humane to have these individuals return to Haiti, and the benefit that this country, especially the state of Florida, gets from the Haitian community is evident. It's not questionable because we are here, we are working, we are supporting, we're helping the community, and we are pouring thousands of dollars back into this community. So I understand when people say this was a temporary status, and we are advocating for long-term status. We want legal permanent residence because these people are part of our communities. These are our families, our friends, our neighbors, our teachers, our nurses, doctors. These are business owners, real estate agents. These are community activists. These are pastors. These are people that we see every day. And so we can't simply say, well, this was a temporary status and you can now leave after they have poured so much into our community. But we can't act like the Haitian community, especially Haitian TPS workers that work in our communities, do not provide essential support to the communities, and that it would be okay to just send them back to a place that simply cannot receive them at the moment.
As someone who has had to calm a lot of fear in the community, has had to fight a lot of misinformation, what's one of the biggest misconceptions you'd want to clear up about what happens next?
Well, I want people to, one, understand that this is a stay. It did not extend TPS how we've seen the administrations previously do. It did not provide a new designation, meaning that this is just a stay for the current TPS that was designated for Haitian TPS holders. This does not mean you need to apply for TPS again. If you already have applied for TPS or have a pending application, there's nothing that you need to do at the moment. So we want people to understand that when there's more information, we will ensure that we have community forums and town halls and virtual spaces where immigration attorneys and other attorneys can share that information to you to ensure that you have it.
Ann Pierville is a Haitian-American attorney in Orlando. The nonprofit Haitian Bridge Alliance estimates that Florida's 158,000 Haitian TPS holders contribute more than $2.5 billion in annual economic contributions and more than $300 million in annual state and local tax revenue. Wesney Theophin, a union organizer in Polk County with Unite Here Local 737, works with other Haitian workers in the hospitality and restaurant industry. He shares what life is really like right now for the employees and their communities.
A relief yesterday was an amazing thing for us because we all were praying God to ask a favor to extend the TPS for my fellow Haitian brothers and sisters. And thanks God, they took a pause on it. Even if it's not an extension, but it means something, and we don't know what will happen next.
How does that uncertainty feel? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, for sure. Like this morning, I spoke to several union committee and members, and we all were still worried about what happened next, because I know that decision will be appealed. Yeah, we don't know what will happen. And also, we hope it might be, they might make a technical decision to support the Haitian people because they really need that.
Can you paint a picture of just what life looks like for the Haitian workers that you represent right now?
I would say even we have joys because of the pause. But like I said, they cannot plan anything, because we don't know what will happen tomorrow. They don't know what will happen for the next couple days or weeks. They can't plan for their future. They can't plan for their families, kids, and a lot of things. They worried about losing houses. They still worried about losing cars. And living without a job is not something someone like to live with.
Wesney Theophin is with the Unite Here Local 737 Union. Coming up, a full orchestra made entirely of clarinets. After hearing from some of the Central Florida musicians behind that music, you may start listening differently. That conversation is next on Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. When you think of the clarinet, you might reminisce about your high school marching band. Maybe your mind goes to the Beatles. Or Supertramp. Hey. maybe like me, you go straight to Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, a song that depicts New York City in a way no written lyric can. Regardless of the genre, if it can be played on a clarinet, the Licorice Sticks will oblige. The Licorice Sticks are a clarinet band. The membership is fluid, but anytime it can boast between 20 and 40 musicians from Central Florida and beyond. They're led by Rick Kissinger, and their programming includes jazz, swing, classical, klezmer, and Latino and world music. Their aesthetic is unique. The Licorice Sticks look like they're stuck in a Depression-era vaudeville show. Think old-timey newspaper boy. But when they hit their stride, they typically tear the roofs off wherever they're playing, which will undoubtedly include the Blue Bamboo, where they're scheduled for a 3 o'clock show this Sunday afternoon. Band leader Rick Kissinger stopped by the Central Florida Public Media Studios this week with bandmates Jonathan Stelzer, a UCF grad, and Joe Fritz, a full-time professional musician. They spoke with Engage producer Richard Copeland about rocking out on the woodwind. Soloist Joe Fritz began the conversation.
My grandfather was a gypsy violinist. I'm from Hungary, Budapest. And my parents want to play only violin, but I was very untalented. So I finished a half year in 4 years. And after my father said, okay, you can put down the violin if you choose another instrument. And I chose the clarinet because my father was a clarinet player before I was born. So I saw the instrument in the cupboard and I heard Benny Goodman and I said, okay, I want this. And he showed, okay, so this is the clarinet, try it. It was in May and I played in the hotel in that year, October. I was 13. So it was an easy choice.
So, you know, you kind of backed into it, but you clearly found a passion for it.
Yeah, that was easy. So I wanted this all my life.
John, how about you?
You know, back in middle school, I was raised in Georgia.
That was like last year.
Yeah, I'm a little young, but back in middle school, I had a band director going into fifth and sixth grade. I have no musicians in my family. I'm the only musician in my family. And it took a band director to come up to me and say, hey, I would really appreciate if you would join band and I think you would have fun. I didn't really know what the clarinet was back then. I played the recorder in third and fourth grade, as we all do. But it was a bunch of happy incidents that let me continue music. And forever, I'm thankful for just keep on pushing through and having my middle school band director just say, hey, you should try band.
Rick, John's experience is similar to a lot of Americans, how they find their way into music and instrument instruction. Is that your experience?
Unfortunately, I have the exact opposite experience. When music was introduced, I really wanted to play percussion. And my mom and dad were like, no. Strangely enough, when my younger brother came along, he got a drum set real quick, but that wasn't for me. So being the oldest of three, I was handed the moldy clarinet in the closet that my mom played when she was in middle school and high school. And she's like, well, if you want to play anything, here's your choice. So at that time, music was not much into my life. And then, okay, well, I'll try the clarinet. I didn't really like it at first, but I started, you know, playing and practicing, you know, sixth, seventh grade. I was terrible. I was absolutely terrible. The light bulb did not click until I was in 10th grade. And here we are today.
Well, tell me about that light bulb. Because when I was in 10th grade, I wanted to play trumpet and wail like Miles. Or I wanted a guitar and wail like Jimmy.
Oh, yeah.
When I think of the clarinet, I think of Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw,
Pete Fountain,
yeah. But not exactly rocking out for a teenager.
Yeah, no, not at all.
You found...
That's why I was like, I wanted to play drums. I'm like, well, what am I going to do with this little clarinet thingy here?
So where did you find the connection with the clarinet? Was there a piece of music that really resonated with you?
Again, I did not like the clarinet for the longest time. And then I, you know, as I matured through middle school, I was like, oh, there's some really cool music for this. And Benny Goodman was actually my idol at the time. Fortunately, my mom had really good taste in music. And besides Peter, Paul, and Mary and Dolly Parton, we listened to a lot of swing. on vinyl. So, and I was like, oh, that's really cool. Listen to that. What is that? And Mom's like, that's the clarinet, duh. I'm like, oh, it does sound cool. So then the lights started coming on, and I didn't really pursue it or concentrate and focus on it until probably about 10th grade. I paid for my lessons in 9th grade trying to, you know, perfect my craft, and it wasn't clicking, you know, and we all mature, you know, musically and mentally at different stages of our life, and if you don't get it right away, just keep going, and then eventually, you know, it's going to click in 10th grade, boom, and then bam, 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 all state, all county, it just, you know, boom, that was it.
So let's talk about the clarinet and the sound, and it can be both, you know, extremely soulful. Gershwin, those opening punch in Rhapsody, just, you know, it sucks you straight in.
Sets the tone.
Sets the tone. It can also be bouncy, playful. I'm thinking When I'm 64, the Beatles. That pops up, doom, doom, that sort of walking clarinet line. But it's got an incredible range.
The theme from Cheers.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that great? Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great
it gets
jingles.
Big on the closing credits on Cheers. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That's great.
So what do you hear when you hear that sound? I'll ask you, John.
I think the big thing is it's a sound you don't hear often nowadays. A lot of the music we listen to now, more electronic oriented, you don't have as much as the musical nuance. And sometimes it takes that single note, like in Rhapsody in Blue, when the clarinet does that gliss, I can't think of another instrument that can sound just like that. So I think it has that very unique sound you don't hear nowadays.
John, what do you hear when you hear that sound? What makes it stand out from the other instruments?
I think the clarinet has maybe 1,000 sounds, and every sound is different. Everybody's sound is different. You can play in a clarinet folk music, classical music, jazz music. If you're very good, maybe you can play funky or some kind of styles. But if Benny Goodman plays an instrument, you know it's Benny. If Artie Shaw, you know it's Artie. If Rick, you know it's Rick. So it's everybody has some own sound on the clarinet. And that's the reason why we choose the clarinet.
Yeah. It's your signature on your own instrument.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the Liquor Sticks. How did this come together as a band?
Well, I woke up one day and I thought to myself, self, let's put a clarinet ensemble together. This was way back in the day. I was 12. And I think we started out with like 8 or 12 people. And it's evolved over the last 20, 25 years into what it is today. We're the only professional group in the state of Florida that performs clarinet ensemble music of all genres of music, incorporating all walks of life, levels of musicians. We have professionals, we have homemakers, we have music educator students. They all come to play, and it's an outlet for everyone to get together. It is a community ensemble, but we're as professional as a community ensemble can get, and it allows people to expand and hone in their craft. And it gives a lot of opportunity to upcoming middle school, high school, and college kids, give them the opportunity to experience something that they would not normally do.
Joe, how did you find your way to the group?
Oh, accidentally. I lived here 12 years ago for a while. And I left the country. I lived in Australia. And when I came back 2 years ago, somebody called me and said, hey, call Rick, because Rick is really angry. I did something maybe back in 12 years.
I'm so glad you're telling the story. This is awesome.
So we met and just figured out, we never talked. Absolutely nothing happened. And he said, okay, if you want to sit in the band, sit in the band. So I sit in the band, and I guess Rick just figured out that, okay, this guy can improvise and jazz things, so.
Yeah, he sounds pretty good. We might as well keep him around. Yeah.
John, how did you find your way into the Liquor Sticks?
You know, I moved to Orlando 2 years ago. I was over at Fort Stewart, Georgia in the Army bands. And then before moving down here, I actually just sent a Facebook messenger to Rick because I was looking for just groups to play in. When I lived in Georgia, I would play in community groups. And it's always fun just to play music with people that truly want to be there for music making, whether it be a clarinet ensemble, which is very unique. There's not a lot of community clarinet ensembles out there, less than 10 maybe. that are like community based. And I think the big thing is just making music that with people that truly want to be there and also make really great music.
So let's talk about the music. I mean, you really cover the just about anything you can do with the clarinet. You guys are doing jazz, swing, classical, klezmer, the sort of Eastern European, Jewish rooted, you know, that's kind
gypsy
of
gypsy music.
Gypsy music, yeah. Talk about putting together a program.
So the music that is written for clarinet going on for 400 years. So any kind of music or style of music that is available can be manipulated or transposed or transcribed for the versatility and the timbre of the clarinet. Because you have, basically, when you have like a band or an orchestra, you have the high reeds, which are the flutes, the piccolos, the clarinets, the oboes, and then it just goes on down low reeds. Then you have brass, trumpet, and trombones. Then you have low brass, which are, you know, bass trombones. You have the bassoons, and then you have tubas and things like that. All of those voicings in a band or an orchestra can be exactly duplicated, not the timbre, but the notes and everything in the clarinet orchestra. So there are a lot of full orchestral and band arrangements that have been transcribed for full clarinet orchestra. Now, we have 30-plus members in our group on a daily basis. Now, when we go to, like, the International Clarinet Festival, we have alumni from across the United States that come and join us for this festival on the weekend. And we've had in excess of 65 people in our ensemble, which demonstrates the versatility of every clarinet that we have, from the A-flat piccolo all the way down to that contrabass clarinet.
All right, so let's hear some music.
So, Joe.
Yeah.
What are we going to be playing on Sunday? Giving us an example of one of your tunes. He's going to be doing several jazz tunes because Joe is our guest Hungarian jazz soloist. And we're lucky to have Joe in our ensemble. We love him. He's awesome. And he's going to be playing tunes like Autumn in New York, My Funny Valentine, New York, New York. We're doing some In the Mood, all of the, you know, fun jazz standards. So Joe's going to be performing the jazz aspect of the clarinet and the clarinet genre of music. Jonathan is going to be performing one of the movements called Fantasia, and that's going to be an exposition of some of the klezmer style for the clarinets. These guys are both going to be playing the B-flat clarinet, and I brought the E-flat clarinet because that's kind of like my trademark. So I'm going to be playing a piece, an excerpt from the solos that we'll be doing on Sunday. My piece is called The Tarantella. So, Joe, you want to go ahead and give them just a brief little doodle from My Funny Valentine or whatever? Yeah. Joe. Yeah. Little My Funny Valentine. Hey, Jonathan, you want to give us a little sample of your Fantasia? Klezmer it up, baby. Klez it up. Beautiful. I like the little gliss at the end there. Was that reminiscent of Rhapsody in Blue?
Yeah, a little bit.
All right. So now we got a little bit of tarantella on the E-flat clarinet, which everybody calls the squeaker. Joe, you want to finish up with
Do you want to play Baby Elephant together?
Oh, we could do a couple measures of Baby Elephant. You have that? You have your part?
Yeah, I can pull it up real quick.
All right. Hopefully it's in the right key cuz I'm playing an A flat. All right, here we go. ¶¶ love it, Joe. Thank you so much. Yes. We don't want to give him too much because it's just a baby. It's not the entire family, right? Yeah. Yeah. It's a good thing we're all full of hot air because that's really what propels our instruments to begin with. So, yeah.
And there
it is. We're off to a great start. Yeah. I got to get in some dad jokes, right?
Rick Kissinger, Jonathan Stelzer, and Joe Fritz are members of the Licorice Sticks. They're playing the Blue Bamboo at 3 this Sunday. We have links on our website, cfpublic.org. That's all for this week's edition of Engage. We need your help with an upcoming show. We're covering the charter conversion at Orange Center Elementary, and we know not everyone experiences this change the same way. If you're a parent, educator, or community member with questions, mixed feelings, or thoughts you'd like to share, we would like to hear from you. You can help us shape the conversation. Send an email to engage@cfpublic.org or send a talkback on the Central Florida Public Media app. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. NPR News is next.